You're all listening to Dr. Radio. I'm Dr. Marina Kurian. I'm a clinical professor of surgery here at NYU Langone Health and NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Rachel Lustgarten is here, my super awesome co-host, and she is a clinical dietitian here in New York City. Joining us for the next half hour is Admiral Brett Girouard. He's a physician scientist and a former admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service, and currently he's a senior advisor to the Sickle Cell Disease Partnership. He's a former assistant secretary for health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And we're going to be talking to him about sickle cell disease, advancing access to care, treatment, and improving outcomes. Welcome, Brett. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I'm so excited to talk about sickle cell disease, which has been a passion of mine for, 35 years, ever since I've been in medical school.
So let's talk a little bit about sickle cell disease, what it is, who gets it, and because there's disease and trait. Everyone should know about that.
So thank you for asking. To clarify that, so sickle cell disease is a disease of the blood molecule called hemoglobin. It's a genetic disease caused by just one change in a DNA base out of the billions that we have. And it can lead to really profound changes and early death, suffering through life, infection, strokes, kidney disease, just an awful disease to have. Now, in order to get the disease, you have to have two copies, one from your mom and one from your dad. And about 100,000 Americans suffer with the disease and millions throughout the world. But as you pointed out, you can also have something called sickle cell trait. That means you carry it. It means you travel in some extreme circumstances like, you know, ultra hiking or
you know, we're going to, yeah, Brett, right. We're going to probably.
But that's very
Brett, we may need to recheck your connection.
Oh, I lost you.
Yeah, we need to just recheck your connection, I think. But great points that you brought up in terms of sickle cell disease
I'm sorry about that. You want me to sign back in? Because I'm hearing you fine.
Yeah, I think so, because your connection's not so great. But I just wanted to...
Let me try something different.
So we are going to... just review again, right, Rachel? Like, you know, we all remember from genetics in school that sickle cell disease and trait are different, but really the genetics part of it, as Dr. Girouard was just saying, is that, you know, in order to get the disease, you have to have both parents give that to the child, and that's the genetic transfer, whereas trait is really only one parent has given that, and it has significant impact in terms of outcomes, symptoms, and what patients experience. And part of that, for those of you listening, you know, you may know someone who has sickle cell disease, and disease is much worse than trait. And what happens is they can have sickle cell crises, and we'll talk to Dr. Girouard about that when he gets back on and what that is. But the treatment for these patients can be so difficult, and it's not unusual that they've already had, you know, surgeries when you meet them because of related to the crises they have and the pains that they can experience from just having this mutation in their hemoglobin.
You know, Marina, we should mention too, we were talking in our previous segment about this being Pride Month, but did you know that it was just World Sickle Cell Day on the 19th of this month? And that this is a disease that impacts 20 million people worldwide. So this is especially timely that we're discussing this condition today.
Yeah. Yes, and it's always, it is great to have World Sickle Cell Day to remind us, because this still is a primary disease in sub-Saharan Africa, where this originated about 7,000 years ago. But it is worldwide. Anywhere there's been a history of malaria, this gene sort of grew, because if you have one copy of the gene, you die less frequently with malaria. Of course, if you have two copies of the gene in general, without appropriate treatment, you die before age 5. Fortunately, in the United States, the life expectancy is about 40, but that's still much too young for 100,000 Americans who suffer with this, and certainly for people around the world.
Yeah, no, and you said that I do remember that the mutation was important because of sort of evolutionary issues and diseases. So it makes a difference. But now that's just with the trait. So with the disease, I was saying when we were trying to get your audio back that, you know, there's differences in symptoms and we briefly touched on sickle cell crises. If you could just run through that for our listeners.
So it's really a life journey for these patients. And again, I'm a pediatric ICU physician by training, and in my former life ran a health system in Dallas, so took care of hundreds of children with this. Right now, children are diagnosed in the United States at birth. So there's neonatal screening, so we know who they are. But children get into trouble very early when the blood starts sickling. And this could be 9 months, 12 months, 2 years of age, where they can have a crises of pain. They can have crises, and most of them do have crises, where they lose their spleen function, and that makes them subject to all kinds of infections. And in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa, where they don't have treatment and vaccines, about 80% of children die before their 5th birthday. So that is just an awful outcome. In the teenage years, it's often very painful, because when the blood sickles, it causes extreme pain in the bones. It can cause problems in the chest called chest syndrome, where it's very hard to breathe and very painful. Children very early, even teenagers, can have strokes. So it really is a terrible disease of extreme and excruciating pain that, unfortunately, people still die in their early 40s in the United States. And there's so many issues. When you talk about health disparities and health equity, this really is the poster child for a lack of health equity, both in terms of research, as well as access to medical care, as well as discrimination in emergency rooms. So, you know, when we talk about things in the abstract, this is something we need to work on now, and something that I worked on all my life, but especially when I was assistant secretary, to improve the lives of people living with this disease.
And when you say health disparities, are we talking about worldwide in terms of, you know, some populations in, as you mentioned, the prevalence in Africa, or are these health disparities an issue in this country as well? And talk about the different groups that are impacted.
I want to focus on America, because mm-hmm. we know there are tremendous health disparities around the world, particularly in countries that have low resources. But in the United States, imagine this. Now, there are only a few treatments for this disease, and really two of the major new treatments came in 2019. When I was FDA commissioner, I had the opportunity to approve those treatments for sickle cell disease. But still, 80% of people in this disease in the United States get no treatment whatsoever. This is a fatal disease of excruciating pain, and they get no specific treatment. Can you imagine, you're a surgeon, Marina, if 80% of people with acute appendicitis didn't get treated, or if 80% of people who had cancer didn't get treated, it would be unimaginable. There'd be a cry from the rooftops. But 80% of people with sickle cell, and again, these are majority African-American and some Hispanics, get no treatment. Even children, less than 50% of them get the immunizations that are life-saving. Less than 50% of them get what's called transcranial Doppler, and that's just an ultrasound that shows the risk for stroke, because again, children could have severe stroke. So there's a tremendous lack of access. And then over the decades, there's been a lack of investment in research, the science of how to put sickle cell in the rearview mirror. That is being remedied pretty quickly right now by the NIH and by private organizations, but it has been a historic disparity. So wherever you look, people with sickle cell disease have not benefited from science. They've not benefited from innovation because we've not invested. And there's a tremendous lack of access into the healthcare system. And these are all things that we can fix. Again, I would urge your listeners, it's great to talk flowery about health disparities and health equity, but the rubber meets the road right here with sickle cell disease, things we can do right now to care for and to improve the lives of this vulnerable community.
And on that same note, we know that you are involved, you're a senior advisor to the Sickle Cell Disease Partnership. What is that and how will it benefit patients with this disease?
So the partnership is a nonpartisan partnership trying to bring together people from different groups. So these are patient groups and patients. These are payers. These are people like Medicaid who have to pay for the services as well as private insurances. It is pharmaceutical companies. It is really everyone who has a stake, including the American Society of Hematology that represents many of the physicians who treat sickle cell. And it's really trying to get specific legislative fixes done that will improve access. When I was the assistant secretary, I sponsored the National Academies of Science, Medicine, and Engineering to do a report, a blueprint on how to fix sickle cell. I knew that I was in the Trump administration. I knew that I would either be there 4 years or 8 years, but I had a timestamp on me. And I wanted to make sure we left behind something that was nonpartisan that the country could follow. And that is the blueprint written by the National Academies. So much of our work in the Levitt Partnership is bringing people together in a nonpartisan way to ensure that the country doesn't forget about the National Academies report. And we have a specific legislative agenda to implement those fixes that will ultimately lead to better care and ultimately a cure for sickle cell disease, because this will be a curable genetic disease. There's no question about that.
That's really exciting. Like, I mean, that's amazing, right? Because this is actually an issue with the RBC and the hemoglobin. So it's amazing that, like, that there's the research and science behind to change that. Like, tell me how, man. I have no idea. I was like, wait, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this goes back to a technology called CRISPR-Cas, where you can replace a defective gene with a normal one. And there are several strategies to do that. But unlike some diseases, you know, we just have to fix it in the bone marrow. We don't have to fix it in every cell in the body because the bone marrow makes the blood. So if you can fix it, and there are several different approaches, then you could cure the disease. And there are indeed clinical trials right now that have been remarkable in terms of its success rate. There is a new treatment called Oxbryta, which is a pill, and there's a second generation treatment coming out. So you don't need to worry about genetic therapies or bone marrow transplants, things like that. It's a pill that actually causes the hemoglobin not to sickle anymore. This is one of the drugs that I approved when I was acting FDA commissioner. And the results have been really remarkable. So short of a fancy genetic therapy that we may have in the future, there are new treatments that are very, very exciting that can be as simple as a pill a day. Now, the question is, it's not curative, but it's extremely helpful. The question is, how do we get more people with sickle cell disease on the medicines they need? And that's health access. That's health equity. That's training more people to understand sickle cell disease. That's empowering the community. People with sickle cell disease who often tend to be poor, right? It's a cycle. If you can't stay in school and you're sick all the time or in the hospital, your parents can't work. So it really is a cycle of poverty within these families. So they generally don't have power, and we're trying to empower them. I did even bring the sickle cell community to the White House when I was there, and we had a meeting with the First Lady about this, both nationally and globally, to gain recognition. Of course, that was in September of 2019, right before the pandemic. So we lost some momentum there that I hope we can pick up again in the Biden administration and the future administrations.
That's great. That's so important. And, yeah. Go ahead, Rachel.
It's so exciting to hear about new treatment options. Talk a little bit about, you mentioned how many people are suffering from this that are not getting adequate treatment. Is it also the case that many people in these underserved populations are presenting in ERs without the knowledge of them having this condition? I know we need to improve how they are treated and how clinicians in ER settings can best help these patients. Is it also the case that some people are going undiagnosed?
That is really would be rare, because we do diagnose people very early. And now, of course, since about 20 years, we've had universal newborn screening. So it would be very unusual for a person to get to the emergency room. The problem, though, as you highlight, and you were right on target, just from a different angle, is that people need to go to emergency rooms because they don't have primary care. They don't have a home, a medical home, and that medical home could be a nurse practitioner, it could be a physician, it could be a pharmacist. I mean, they need someone to provide them constant care, and if they don't, when they get ill, they go to the emergency room. The issues about emergency rooms are very, emergency rooms are a terrible place to get primary care. But if you're in excruciating pain, just think about the worst pain, childbirth, kidney stones. This is what these people have weeks, months per year. They go to the emergency room, and often emergency room physicians are not as trained to take care of people with sickle cell disease. And there's been a history of discrimination. When a person comes in with pain, they think they're okay. You're a drug addict. You have a substance use disorder. So it's very well documented that people with sickle cell disease get less pain medicines than they need in emergency rooms, and they get it after waiting a prolonged period of time. We tried to change this. This is rapidly evolving. Emergency room physicians are doing their best. When I was in administration, we published an entire supplement for emergency medicine to help train physicians. We did a special carve out for opioid restrictions for people with sickle cell disease, much like cancer. Because it's awful if they need pain medication. We want to give new drugs to avoid pain crises. But if you're in pain, you need pain medication, and the best pain medication are still forms of opioids. So there's a lot of issues around the emergency room, and we could remedy that by giving a medical home to these individuals to prevent them from getting pain crises in the first place. But secondly, if they get one, to be able to be treated by their personal nurse, pharmacist, physician, instead of heading to the county emergency room, which is, a really bad place to get primary care.
Yeah, plus there's that bias. There is that little bit of bias as well when you show up in the ER for primary care reasons, because the ER staff is usually so slammed that it's hard
It's slim, hard to
reconcile.
In the area of COVID, they're busy, but ERs are there to take care of, you have a person in pain, but then you have a 10-car wreck that comes in with trauma and gunshot wounds. It's just emergency rooms, God bless everyone who works in them, but they're not a good place to get primary care or to take care of something like sickle cell. So again, the partnership under Leavitt, Governor Leavitt was Secretary of Health and Human Services. He's also governor of Utah. And we do pride ourselves on being science-based and nonpartisan. We have a lot of leaders from the Obama administration, the Bush 43 administration. I was in the Trump administration as a public health person. We have people from congressional staff on both sides. We have President Obama's deputy chief of staff in the White House. It really is a nonpartisan group because, look, we can all agree that 100,000 Americans who have literally a terminal disease deserve care. And if we want to talk about health equity and health disparities, we could do something now. And that's really what this coalition is about. And there's some specific legislation that has gotten introduced that is going to move the ball forward. And we're very excited about that. And so is the sickle cell community.
That is exciting because it's so important. And I love the movement and the support that you're getting on so many different levels. And as well, you said private organizations We do have a call, actually. We you know, it's great about our listeners. They got our number, right? They know when to call. We didn't even ask. I was so fascinated by, you know, what you were talking about. But you guys who are listening, if you have questions for Dr. Brett Girouard, we are talking about sickle cell disease and what are the options, and kind of talked about what it is, et cetera. But it's over 100,000 families, right, Brett, in this country that are affected. And so if you want to join our conversation, you can at 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627. Or email us, docs at SiriusXM.com. And we're going to Carrie in North Carolina. Carrie, welcome. What is your question or comment?
Well, thank you. And one thing I just have to comment, which is not related to my question, is thank you for your comments on people who have chronic diseases still needing pain meds, because that's a huge fear that I have, is that with all the current regulations and such, that there's going to be a point when those of us who really need them aren't going to be able to get them. So thank you for validating that there's still a need for those. My question is, though, actually, I have atypical HUS, which is a complement-related disease, but also like overseen by my hematologist. So when you have your statement about, you know, potentially being able to, you know, cure with like genetic modification sickle cell disease, I was wondering if that is something that's like going to be transposable to other diseases, like with mine having a genetic defect in like C3 of the complement system, or what your kind of thoughts are on the future of that, just kind of related to some other diseases.
So thank you for that. I don't know about your specific disorder, and I wish you the best for dealing with this chronic condition. I know it can be debilitating, but so right now many of these disorders of the blood can be fixed, but they require sort of almost a bone marrow transplant, right? So they take your bone marrow out, then they fix your bone marrow, but get rid of all the rest of the bone marrow that's there, because you got to make a space for this. So it does require some pretty toxic medications. The goal in the future, and there's a lot of work, is to not give you the toxic medications, literally just to give you a drug IV that will replace your gene. So yes, sickle cell is the one that is on everyone's radar because of the 100,000 Americans, and it's only a single defect. But yes, all these other disorders will be subject to this great, exciting gene therapy from a technology called CRISPR-Cas.
That's really amazing. You know, we are running out of time. I want to thank you again for all the information you shared with us. Again, he is a senior advisor to the Sickle Cell Disease Partnership, and they're making significant headway. How exciting to just get an IV treatment, like seriously, compared to, you know, multiple weeks of this and that. It's extremely, innovative and amazing. Again, Admiral Brett Girouard, former Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He is currently in Texas and working, but he's also Senior Advisor of the Sickle Cell Disease Partnership. Stay tuned, everyone. We are going to shift gears, Rachel Lusgarden and myself, Marina Kurian. We're going to talk to Dr. Kathy Dieringer about reducing injuries at camp or during summer activities. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.